Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Eleanor Hooker. Eleanor Hooker is an Irish poet and writer whose first collection, The Shadow Owner's Companion, was shortlisted for the 2012 Strong Shine Award. Her second book, A Tug of Blue, is forthcoming in 2016. She has appeared in journals worldwide, including Poetry Ireland Review, Poetry, out of Chicago, and the PN Review from the UK. She holds an MPhil in creative writing and is a helm and press officer for the Loch Derg Lifeboat. Hi, Eleanor. How are you?
Very well. Thank you very much for having me.
We're so thrilled to have you from Ireland all the way to Pittsburgh, so welcome.
Thank you very much. It's very exciting.
Okay. So you can start with a poem from your book, The Shadow Owner's Companion.
Yes, this is the title poem. Okay. The Shadow Owner's Companion. Solitary. She's been around for so long now, we simply coexist. I know she's there. At night, she rocks in the left corners of our bedroom, her chair held together with my fear of the dark. She stays there, mostly, in the dark. Sometimes she sleeps at the bottom of the lake. She wakes me in my dreams and I ignore her. But then she does her special trick, hovers just above me, her weight not on me. I spoon up to you. I'm frightened, I say. Mind me. And you warn me not to tell. My dreams, they frighten you too. I won't look at her. I know she could never be unseen, unheard of, forever and ever. Doppelganger, after Neruda. When did she come in search of me? No, I cannot say either. Out of the lake and into the air, forever marked by dusk, she is nourished by under-earth fusty decay, blue in summer, green-eyed in winter. I don't believe she has screeched in any of our collaborations, yet it's others she favors with ancient eucalyptus, with willow myrtles. I am her pupil too, and would love her more than she needs me to hate her. In deadly night, she gives me a trope of belladonna, dilates my pupils so wide, the light in everything is expressed and swallowed and expressed. She hums Prokofiev while I try to discover the words for her song in my own slurred voice. Mirrored. She visited again last night. No pike this time. She was singing too. Her song is the sound of a heavy body dragging itself deadly up the stairs. Her malady not due to similar to that thud-thump heartbeat in my ears. She brought mirrors into my mind, and in my mind she filled the mirrors with crows, huge-beaked hungry crows that fed. And though I couldn't move, I kept my eyes open. I wasn't frightened. I knew sooner or later I'd wake, and she would have to leave with her mirrors and her crows, leaving my pulse behind. Nailing wings to the dead. Since we nail wings to the dead, she calls ravens from the sky to inspect our work. For flight, they say, first remove their boots. She leans in, inspects a fresh hex behind my eyes, takes my feet and lays them on the fire to burn it out, root first. We're the last, Babichka and me. We've survived on chance and bread baked from the last store of grain. And as we're out of both, we'll die soon. They are gathering in the well. We disrobe. She hums whilst I nail her wings. She tells me a tale, her last gift. This dark stain past kiss to kiss-stained fevered mouth blights love, is pulsed by death watch beetles tick, timing our decay. They know this. They wait by water, gulping despair. The ravens keep watch. They say the contagion's here. They promise to take us first. Her tail done, we go winged and naked to the well. We hear them climbing the walls, caterwauling. But ravens are swift and swoop.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Eleanor Hooker. She's reading from her book, The Shadow Owner's Companion. Eleanor, I wanted to ask you about the spooky nature of your poetry that seems to run through a lot of a lot of your work. I mean, I'm just thinking of the poems you just read in terms of, you know, otherworldly references and the underneath, the ancient eucalyptus, the... I really love the last poem, you know, Nailing Wings to the Dead. It's not just, not only a reference in your poems, it's in the title, it's all the way through. So I want to ask you, what compels you towards the otherworldly in your poetry?
I think it's a love of myth and fairy tales and how I enjoy the otherworldliness of it. I enjoy the spookiness of it. And to be honest with you, it allows me to express some of the darker thoughts. Some people I know ask, did I actually write my poetry? Because it seems so at odds with my personality. I seem bubbly, and then I have all this dark stuff seeping out into my poems. And sometimes I'm frightened by what I write. I want to write pink and fluffy and not dark and rough, but that's the way I write, and I can't do anything other than that.
Do you really want to write pink and fluffy?
No.
I didn't believe you. No.
I tried. I tried once, and I think I said it to you before, that I tried to write pink fuchsias, and I end up writing flowering cacti. And so I'm resolved to that.
Well, but I think you're bringing up a really important point that, you know, some of what you write frightens you. And I think that happens to a lot of writers. And I think it is part of why some writers stop writing. But, you know, what do you do when you... when you write something that frightens you, what enables you or allows you to keep going?
For a long time, I self-censored, and I would put my work away, and I was a secret writer. And when I showed it, my writing to a friend at home, she said, you must do something with this. And then I showed it to another poet, and he said, why are you hiding it? You know, what are you afraid of? And I was afraid of exposure. I was afraid of people psychoanalyzing me and telling me that there was something, some aberration, something wrong with me. From childhood, I've always been told, you know, you can't. And so really, to allow myself the permissions, I keep a dream diary, and I used to do lucid dreaming. But that can be very frightening, because unless you can control it, it can really bring you to the edge of the abyss. And there's nothing worse than looking into the abyss and nothing looks back at you. So it's a form of control. But I've stopped self-censoring. I think I've earned my wrinkles. And so I've earned my poems. And if people don't like them, I don't mind anymore.
That's great. Yeah, it sounds like it's been a long way to get there.
Yeah.
Okay, can you read some more poems?
Of course. Storm Song. The autumn line storm bears the lake to my door, and in the pounding water is my menagerie of three-eyed fish, and in the ardent air, an arabesque of ravens and rooks. This porous house has never resisted. The wind on knots and all rain in. Once inside, my fishes and the birds resume their routine of swim and storm song. I find breathing space on a bloated chest, rise to the rafters with a raven and a rook beside me, monitoring the flood. Attic curtains spinnaker, and the house runs before the wind. In large, dense shoals, my fish dive free to the deepest available water, drawing down the broken echoes of my humming, sending back up the stormy shadows of my song. Weathering. I keep my appointment with rain. We meet in the wrong room, upstairs. Rain is melancholy. She rinses a naked bulb that's hung itself on white wire. It ran out of light, she said, spreading her fall from the room's unfathomed sky. Rain inquires if I've brought questions. I am allowed four only. Before I can deny it, she presses her sodden lips to mine. Not now, she says. They are come. The sash windows unlace their gowns so that ghost ships, dragging nets filled with memories absolved by rain, can sail through them. And as we watch, rain says, these are your questions. Why is it they hide in there? Why is it they turn from me? Is it to the same place they go? And is it the same story they weather? Rain says, there is no tenderness in the absence of joy. And in the absence of joy, songbirds squabble. When there is nothing left to say, rain envelops me. Her hair lies on my face like tears. And inside my closed mouth, hummingbirds fly backwards into my throat. Upended. Upended and afraid. Everything gets through. Rain pushes under slates and spits on the floor. Wind moans in the walls as darkness shuffles through rooms, jarring the shade. I am a solitary creature who was told not to be a solitary creature, to let others in. Into what, I wonder? There's just me and an echo in here. An echo that cries over and over, "Let me out, let me out." Escape route. You fix our ladder in the scorched earth. Watch as the crows crowd round us. I hear their cautionary cacaws, but cover your ears against their thin black sermons. And so we climb, me, then you. Round, we stroke each bird, sedate and clerical. One bestows a molted quill feather, colour run like oil-marked silk. Is it an omen, you ask? Should we go back? I don't answer. I'm too busy holding up the sky.
You have a poem called Nightmare. I was wondering if you were...
Would you happen to read
it? Yeah, would you read that?
Nightmare. A cobalt night in blue relief and the hunt begins. The green grass black and the talking baby frightens me. Bug-eyed horrors hover in our shadows, lingering, carnivorous. Wailing now to let him stay, he stumbles after, the talking baby. Drop under the yickety-yackety picket fence, a treacherous fork in the road. I know well the dangers. Where I go, the baby follows. I urge him back to the black-green grass behind the yickety-yackety picket fence. You'll be safer there, I promise. He crawls back under with pleas to follow. We neither saw the pit he fell in velvet silence. A small hand held the edge, but slipped away beneath my grip. A cobalt night in blue relief, and the hunt begins.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty. My guest today is the poet Eleanor Hooker, reading from her book entitled The Shadow Owner's Companion. Well, thanks for reading that poem. I love that poem, and I've heard you talk about that poem as something that came to you in one piece. Is that correct?
Yeah. I went to the hairdressers and I asked for a pen and paper, and they watched me scribble it down, and it hasn't been changed. It's based on a parent's worst nightmare, losing a child, and I had to write it, and it came out of a nightmare. You know the way in dreams things disassociate themselves and present themselves as something strange. I had to write it down, and once I wrote it down, then it was okay. I'd sort of settle things with myself.
So you were at the hairdresser, and so it wasn't right after you woke up or something?
No. But it was in my head, like, you know those tunes that you can't get out of your head, mm-hmm. and you're humming? And so even driving in, as it came to me, I was reciting it in the car to mm-hmm. myself. Poems often, they come as concepts, as ideas, and they never come as words, but this was something that had an urgency, and it was brimming up, and I had to get it out.
Hmm. Well, I'm glad you asked for the piece of paper.
Yes.
See, I wanted to talk about sound for a minute, because whenever you read, that's all I think about is the sound. And I also heard you talk about form recently, where you talked about it as something that was given to you and that something that you didn't think you could depart from, that you had to stay to a particular form. So I'm wondering if some of the sounds that I'm hearing are from this loyalty to form.
Yes, initially I thought a villanelle had to be written in a certain way, in a sestina, in a sonnet. And then I was reading other people's work. I was voraciously eating, and my life was all reading poetry. And then I thought, these guys are breaking all the rules. And how come I'm told I can't? And so I found that form was a good way to contain an idea. So you just didn't write the Iliad. You know, you could contain it on one page. But then breaking the rules actually was another freedom. It's like writing a poem and having that urgency to write a poem, but holding your breath until you get to the last line. And then suddenly, you know, that was what form did. It constrained me. It was like being in a straitjacket or writing with my hand behind my back. Mm-hmm. And then I found the freedom to say, you know, you have to know the rules, but knowing the rules means then you can break them.
Right. And in terms of sound, do you think that early, maybe loyalty to form forced you into some sound usage, or was sound always your love?
I love the musicality of poetry. I think it's an oral art. And, some people do kill their poems when they read them aloud, and then others bring them to life. And when I walk my dogs, and one of my dogs gets very anxious when I start reciting poetry, because they know there's no other human with me. It's just that me and the dogs. And she frets. But that's how I decide if a poem is finished. And if I can recall a poem from first to last, then I also know it's done. Poems that I can't recall, I feel they need more work.
Mm-hmm.
And they sit at the top of my mind, and I can recall them verbatim. And then they sink as other poems come up to the surface. But that is a test that I'm not involved in any workshops. So mm-hmm. those are the tests I set myself. Mm-hmm.
Can you go back to the dog part? Are you saying that your dog lets you know if the poem's finished?
No, fret when I start talking to myself. They know that there's nobody else there. And
yeah.
and because I'm in the country, there's nobody else to disturb me. So I recite them at the top of my voice.
See. I got it.
I'm sure the men in white coats someday will come along. And
I thought you were letting your dog tell you that.
They're good critics.
They could be.
Yes.
Yeah. It could be. Okay, we're ready for some more poems.
Conceive. The epigraph from this poem is by George Surtees. It's from a tweet he tweeted March 21st, 2014. Let us imagine sleep suddenly like a child's shadow leaping round the corner. They are shown backlit negatives, trembling there a caged pump, fugitive and rare. They're told to hope for winter. Latin name, chordae tendinae. Heartstrings torn from their winch, fastened to a fleet dropped fall that cannot winter. No keepsakes, none. They're wrought by the negatives, but must cope. He carves you, while she unlearns their child's winter cry. The present. I went inside a clock. My daemon unlocked the back, told me to take my time as he laced me into my snow boots. Nervous. I almost forgot the present. In the blizzard room, snow globes bloomed on icicle spears. A mammoth nudged a blown orb along a frozen gully. Preserved inside the glass was my old schoolroom. Chalk flakes dusted the gaping floorboards, and huddled beneath the timbers were my classmates, petrified and silent. My daemon took me by the hand and led me to the room of rankings, a parched outside-inside plot. Ladders fixed in caked earth leaned against a bruising sky. My daemon said, a bruising sky has beaten. It can no longer assure the stars. Let us go from here. So we left it to its shame. In the lens room, the clock face turned to watch us. At the center of the chamber, I hummed my tuneless rhyme, and from one wall, my little girl stepped out of time. She clutched my tattered present. You mustn't hold on. Let her go now. Let her be, my daemon said, as I drew her close. Watermarked, In Memoriam Seamus Heaney. At 13, my chosen poem, Rite of Spring, though disallowed in lessons, reveal the thrill of ambiguity in its suggestion of the carnal, a stark rite of passage. Today I'll stow your verse in the bow of my craft, guard your door into the dark, a treasured first impression. I'll row rhyme to the centre of October, then further into open water to catch a zephyr, to drift the lake's cool blue afternoon. Here, a scribbled sky's unstrung pearl slips through its border, and watermarked mimics moon. There, a skein of geese assumes the rusty air of a potting shed door, their rising path oblique. But being no longer here nor there, I must find you now in open ground. Take up your postscript and speak your words to Clare's wild shore, where, due west on Sleevaughty, a stony up againstness is halting time at Bohatch Dolmen, where they appear, all standing waiting.
Eleanor, there seems to be a lot of blue in your poems, and I know that your new book is called A Tug of Blue. Can you talk about what's moved from your first book to your second? What things do you notice shifting and changing in terms of craft or what you're working on?
I think I'm more experimental. I'm moving away from form and going more to free verse. There is a certain liberation after a first book. You sort of feel you've got all that stuff out of the way, perhaps autobiographical stuff out of the way. I'm not prepared to be so opaque anymore. I don't feel any need to protect people. And if they don't, you know, I said that earlier, if they don't like the poems, that's okay. These are the poems that I write. And if they don't like them, they shouldn't read them. And if they do like them, they should read them and talk about them and talk about them to me, because there's nothing worse than writing into the void for, you know, to write a poem and nobody comes back to you, because I believe that a poem is complete once it's been read, once a reader picks it up. And even if they don't engage with you, it's nice to know. Sometimes I get tweets and somebody said, I've read your poem and it meant a lot to me. And that means a huge amount to me.
Right. So you said you want to be less opaque, so you're looking for more clarity
yeah.
in your work.
And not in a narcissistic way, but it helps me to understand some of the darkness in my own thoughts. Not to blanch them and not to whitewash them, but just to be comfortable with it. There's still a lot of stuff I need to resolve for myself. Mm-hmm. I don't see poetry as therapy, but I certainly see it as a letting go or a letting out.
Mm-hmm. And you said you're moving towards the more experimental, moving towards free verse, which certainly free verse can be very narrative and not experimental. So
Perhaps not so much in form, but maybe in content, that it'll be more experimental.
Okay.
That is not strictly narrative and not strictly lyrical. It was wonderful to be at your workshop and to hear all the different women finding their way into poetry at their stage, because at home I would be considered an old poet, or coming to poetry later.
Mm-hmm.
And not to have to justify that, and certainly not to have to justify that in the content of what I write.
Right.
And just to let go. I suppose like burning a brassiere, you know. I'm coming to the 1960s really late.
Well, welcome.
Thank you.
So we have time for some more.
The epigraph to this poem is from Umberto Eco, and it's, I do not close my lips by opening yours. Silence. Hoarse from speaking to herself, she seals her lips with a single suture. She has trapped her voice inside. Screams no longer cut her lips to draw another's blood. She believes she will sail deeper oceans on this avowal of silence. She becomes weightless, swallowing words her thoughts prompt her not to speak. When I unpick the stitch, she says she has no desire to be saved. As she steps up to the life raft, I take her hand, alarmed by this new storm blowing through us. The epigraph from this poem is by Tracy Brimhall, and it's, I don't want to be buried, and I certainly don't want to be incinerated. And I love the idea of being fossilized. And my husband said, you know, I'll go to jail if they find you in the lake, because they'll accuse me of all sorts of things. But I like the idea of being fossilized. It takes a long time, and you have to find a certain spot. But it's a nice idea, and fresh water runs over you and goes into every cell, and you become this fossilized creature. And maybe that's my ego. I want to be preserved rather than destroyed or fed to worms. Ablution. And the epigraph is by Tracy Brimhall. Ghost me, fossil me, resurrect me near dawn. On my father's side, I am part fish. When I am dead, return me to water. That part of me which is raven on my mother's side will submit. Do not waste time. Do not bury me or feed me to maggots. Return me to water. I've shown you where. The flow is steady there at that point. Don't reduce me to ash. Petrify me. Bed me in the fresh lake whose virtue is to harden heart to stone. The sediment will own me. Preserve me from foragers. Minerals will fill me. Form stone crystal casts of every sealed cell, deathbound inside me. Return me to water, and no church, please. This is my wish. From my father's side, I am part fish.
Well, I really like that. I'm still back with, I want to be fossilized. I'm still stuck on that. I know, I've never thought of that, I can say.
It's a nice idea. I don't know how legal it would be.
It doesn't sound appealing to me.
Oh, doesn't it?
No.
No. And you have to position yourself in a river that isn't fast flowing, because you don't want to be fossilized headless. You know, you don't want a fast flow of water. I thought this through.
Yeah, yep. I guess so. Okay.
Encrypted. They put us in the crypt, my twin and I. She died before we were born, oh, many years ago. I eat the dark so she can see me. She plucks an acorn from my iris, says my eyes are the precise color of forest floor she'd imagined. Tugging at my raven wings, she asks to keepsake one black feather. She swims in my sea skirt, and when she tires, gathers perfect pebbles. A collector, I think. I've resolved to collect you too, she murmurs, counting six fingers on her left hand. A weather eye. At home, animals can be identified by the tag on their ear, and it identifies who the owner is and who the farmer is, who owns the herd, and especially if they stray into another field, they can identify whose are theirs. And this poem it's a story told sort of slant of people who remain anonymous when they die. And I think all these people who are dying in the Mediterranean and dying in Syria need to be named because we need to know who they are. And so this creature had something awful done to it, so nobody could identify. And I think everybody's has the right, even creatures have the right to be identified. A weather eye. The afternoon a dead calf drifted to our shore was not the first unexpected happening of the day. The calf, bloated under vellum, her brown boots fastened by reeds, lay with her head extended and right eye fixed in an empty sky, fearful. But water is tender to the dead and will return what it cannot own, eventually. I make two calls. I tell them of the calf. They say, you okay? They say, check its tag. They say, wait. They say, do nothing till we're there. I step into the shallows, and water sensing life attempts to fill my boots. As I crouch, the dead calf lifts her head, drunkenly. She fixes on my dogs, but they are good creatures. They sit and wait when told. She turns her frozen gaze to mine, tilts her head that I may see the pink serrated edge of bone where her ear and tag were severed. She senses the buzzards I know are watching from their loop of sky. Some days, exhausted by the sights daylight thrusts upon them, collapse early into the bony hours of dark. The afternoon a dead calf came to our shore was one such day, with nothing to be done by us till sunrise. And at sunrise she was gone. Wind had changed, so water took her elsewhere. Earlier, when I had shrugged into Granny's old warm winter coat, her voice fell from inside one sleeve. It must have snagged there years ago. She said, keep a weather eye, my dear. The unusual is to be guarded against, always.
The poetry of Eleanor Hooker. Thank you so much. That was great.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Prosody, WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the arts entertainment news weekly published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in every Saturday morning at 6:30 for Prosody, 90.5 WESA.